Well, Gene Glynn was around for a long time, and to be around that period of time, third base coach, bench coach, the way you've done it, you have to sort of absorb defeats and understand baseball, don't you? And I imagine he had that ability.
Yeah, he had the ability. Look, when you play every day, you need to, when the game's over, at some point in time, you have to look to the next day and put that day behind you because the games keep coming. Gino was very quirky, and one thing I'll never forget about him is he was quirky in the fact when the game was over, and I had never seen this. The game's over. Say you lose a tough game. You go into the clubhouse. Most of the coaches, you sit in your locker. Your head's down. You're thinking about the game. Most of the guys are grabbing a drink of some sort, a cold beverage, as they're sitting there contemplating the game. And before you wait about 20 minutes before you go get something to eat, let the players go get something to eat. But Gino would come in after a tough loss. He put his head down, and in about 2 minutes he'd go, "Oh, what a shame." And he wasn't being funny. He would just say, night after night, "What a shame." Then he would get up, take off his clothes, and he'd go, "Well, that's baseball." And he'd go in and he'd shower. So he always showered before he went to eat. But, when he would say, "What a shame," and then, "That's baseball," I got the biggest kick out of that, and it made you smile a little bit. But and he washed it off, and he was ready for the next day.
Hmm. Where is he now? Do we know where he is now?
Yeah, he's in Minnesota, and I think he's the third base coach or the bench coach. I can't remember which one it is, but he's still coaching. Yeah.
Really? Okay. All
yeah.
Right. Oh, that's
yeah.
Interesting. I love doing this because I learned so much. The other one I was going to do, I'll just throw it out there, was Luis Pujols. How about him?
Well, Louis came over with Felipe, and that was, they're good fishing buddies. And I didn't know much about Louis other than the fact that he, I played against him when he was in Houston. I didn't know him. I remembered him as a catcher in the major leagues and my brief stint with Pittsburgh. But him and Felipe were fishing buddies. They live close to each other in Florida. And he came over after he was the manager of the Detroit Tigers. He actually had an opportunity to manage Detroit. So he came over, and he was Felipe's right-hand man. He coached third for us, and him and Felipe would, Louis being a catcher, they were real big on controlling the running game. And Felipe and Louis did something that you don't see any other coaches doing, and they've been doing this the whole time they worked together because they worked together in Montreal as well. So when the catcher looks to the manager, to get signs, a throw over sign, a slide step, a hold and step off, Louis and Felipe would both give signs to the catcher at the same time.
Okay.
So the other opposing manager and coaches that are trying to steal the signs didn't know which guy was actually giving the signs. So they did that the whole time that they were together with us. They'd both give signs.
Wow.
Have you seen that, Bill?
I've seen it on benches, but I never, like what you're talking about, that's real interesting. But I wanted to bring up a point that you were talking about, and Marty, you can join in too. Back in the day when a manager picked his coaching staff, he usually picked guys that he played with or were very fond of. I remember Jimmy Davenport picking Rocky Bridges and some of the guys that they went through the wars with, through the minor leagues. And teams now are changing because the manager really doesn't get to pick his whole staff. What is the difference with that, Ron, than in the past years when we played, when the manager knew everybody on his right side and everybody on his left side, and they were buddies off the field, and they were, a war team when they got on? Tell me a little different of what you think it was back then to compare now.
Well, that's a good point, Bill. And Marty, you've seen it as well. I mean, the 8 times I had a chance to interview for managing positions, one of the first things you do is you look to put your coaching staff together, and you feel like, hey, if I can bring good people to the table, this organization, it may help me as a manager as well. And usually in these interviews, they ask you, who you want. Mm. And you got to remember, you know, back in the day, I think one of the most important things, whether it's back in the day or now, and you're picking a coaching staff, you know, you want people that are loyal and you can trust, number one. And, you know, as the manager, I think a lot of times managers went with guys that they knew that they can trust. And usually they're picking someone as well that is hardworking and credible. Mm-hmm. You know, those were the mm-hmm. biggest qualities I looked for, is someone that was mm-hmm. loyal. I could trust him because, you know, you're going to need your coaches. You need all six people pulling on the same rope. If there's any dissension on the coaching staff, the players know it, and it just permeates, just like if you have a couple players that are upset. So I think the way the game was structured, the manager had the decision to pick his coaching staff. You know, then it was a give and take. You know, when you interview for a job, I never expected to have my whole coaching staff, but I expect to have, you know, two or three guys minimum that would help mm-hmm. me accomplish what I want. And that seems to be going out the wayside because the managers aren't getting paid as much. The front mm-hmm. office is picking the coaches along with the manager, right. and they're not giving the manager that luxury. So it really right. has changed 100% on how they mm-hmm. go about putting a staff together.
Yeah, it's more teaching, more teaching now, more analytics and that kind of stuff. You got to bring that to the table first. I think that's mm-hmm. what you got to do. Yeah, that's a good question. That's a good question. Well, we've got more information about Gene Glynn from Doug Greenwald. Gene Glynn won the first Minnesota Mr. Basketball Award, honored by the state of Minnesota in 1975. How about that, Woe? And that's it. Now he ended up with the Twins, so there's the connection.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Gino, he was a competitor, whether he was playing ping pong.
He's a short guy, isn't he? He's not that tall to be playing basketball.
Who, Doug Greenwald?
He had to be a guard.
Well, Doug and Gene Glynn, they're both small.
All right. See, isn't it beautiful that we have our own Google out there? Just ask the question. All right. All right. Did you guys see the movie League of Their Own? Did you guys see that and enjoy the movie?
Of course.
Yeah.
Enjoyed it very well.
Yeah, today is one of the anniversaries. I guess Bill Lee, Spaceman, his aunt, pitched in the league and pitched a number of perfect games and no-hitters and threw one, I think, her first today way back in the 40s. So how about that? Bill Lee's aunt throws a perfect game in the All-American Girls Baseball Professional Association. How about that?
Well, you know, that movie, of course, came out, and the greatest line they had was "There's no crying in baseball" by Tom Hanks saying that. And, you know, I coached women's softball, girls' softball in high school, and for 15 years, I mean, it was very similar. I mean, a male head coach and females on your team, and you know, that whole movie was just so dynamic of all the highs and lows of women in baseball and softball and things like that, and all the trials and tribulations from all the fans and all the things they said. But Gina Davis, Madonna, those were two of the great actresses in that movie. And, of course, Tom Hanks is the manager. You didn't go wrong with that movie. That was a good baseball movie.
Did you know Bill Lee?
Yeah, Bill,
I did know Bill Lee. I knew Bill Lee real well. I never knew his mom. You said his mom was a player?
His aunt.
I didn't even know that.
His aunt.
Oh, his aunt. Yeah, Bill Lee was in my era, you know, put a little marijuana on your Wheaties and go get them kind of guy. And and he was out there. He was a spaceman. He did a lot of crazy things. And, he pitched very well. He had the Yeefus pitch. He had that real slow curveball, competitor with the Red Sox for years.
Yeah, Bill, that's what I remember about Bill Lee growing up in New England. Of course, I went to Fenway Park once a year. That was our big trip. Our dad would take us to see the Red Sox. He was a Red Sox fan. And of course, Bill Lee was, as you said, he was there. And I remember him as much as any pitcher, him and Louis Tion, right? Because they were colorful. Mm-hmm. Tion had that unique delivery. And, of course, Bill Lee, the spaceman, you know, he brought a lot of color to the game. And you didn't forget that. And I remember the Yeefus pitch. You know, your mouth would just hang open when he threw that Yeefus pitch and strike somebody out. It was like the greatest thing in the world to see. And that was it. I remember watching him as a kid. And of course, talking about that in the movie League of Our Own, it reminds me of the Silver Bullets. Remember the women's professional team that was put together that the Negroes managed and coached. And yeah, great movie. I think it was great for baseball, and it was great to see the Silver Bullets bouncing around for a few years there as well.
Yeah, Bill Lee threw one too many EFIS, I'll tell you that, to Tony Perez.
That's true.
Well, Tony can hit now. Tony's going to get you.
Yeah, man, that changed the whole world, so that changed Game 7. You know, how do you throw that pitch at Tony Perez? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, yeah.
In a game that means the world, too. And he did it, and Tony didn't move, and he hit the hell out of it. I still remember that to this day, how he smoked that ball. Tony Perez was a power hitter. I don't think you're going to fool him too much.
You know, I'll tell you, I've said this on the show over the years, and, you know, you go to the ballpark, and we may have talked about this. There's certain hitters when you just – all you got to do is listen to the sound. And for me – and Michael Gaines, our my dear friend, we went to so many Giant games together at Candlestick. Cesar Cedeno and Tony Perez. All you had to do was listen when they hit the ball.
Yeah, no, there's no question. There's a different sound off of those big boys' bats. And, you know, I talk to a lot of people that have been in the game a lot longer than me. And, you know, the ones that played alongside Tony Perez. And I thought he was one of the greatest RBI men of all time. You know, he could sniff that RBI and get that runner in. And, you know, he could hit with power. He'd do whatever he needed to do. And, you know, Pujols did a little bit of that. He was a very similar hitter. You know, Pujols was known for his home runs, but he became, you know, just an outstanding hitter as he got older, you know, taking the base hit to right. They would shift on him, but if there was two strikes and a guy on second, he just poked the ball over there to get the run in. And, you know, it was a lot more valuable when Tony Perez was playing. I mean, guys got paid for the RBIs and getting that run in, and it's not talked about all that much anymore.
Well, I can tell you, Marty and Ron, I could name you about 50 more guys that could hit the ball that hard because they whizzed by my ears for many years. And those are the times, boy, there was some balls, you know, as you saw them go past you, that's how hard they were hit. And, I mean, those are the ones that scare you because those are the ones that can knock you out. And we all know how many line drives have hit pitchers' faces or parts of their bodies. And I tell you what, some of those guys, when they connected, it was just bullets and BBs coming back at you. And I would have to agree to you, Tony Perez was one of those guys.
Well, the best story I ever heard was big Frank Howard, Hondo. 6 foot, you know, 6 foot eight out of Ohio State, Dodger, Washington, Tiger. He'd hit a line drive that would go past the shortstop at his shoulder and end up in the upper deck in Detroit. I mean, that's how he could, yeah.
Yeah, heard a lot of things about him. He was obviously a big man and a big presence in the game of baseball. You know, you can hear stories about him. People loved him.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah,
they tell stories.
To meet him. I got to meet him. He was a coach. He was a coach in the big leagues. And one of the days I went over to see how big he was, and he was mammoth. I mean, his hands were like Willie Mays' hands, twice the size of your hands, and his forearms were like Frank Robinson's. I mean, he was just so solid. And I bet you if he was in the weight room, he could have probably been a lot better. But, you know, back then, the burly guys were making it as big-time home run hitters.
Yeah, I got to interview him. I think he was a coach with Tampa Bay when I got to interview him. I've got it in the archive somewhere. And the thing about him is that he would, after the game, he'd go back to the hotel room, and he would wipe out the mini bar, you know, all the little bottles. I mean, just every one of them, he would wipe them out. That was Frank Howard.
Boy. Yeah.
Great. I mean, this is a part of baseball I love. You know that. It's good. All right. Anniversary today, 1892. All right. The year doesn't matter, but it's the first pinch hitter in baseball ever, 1892, for the Cleveland Spiders against the Brooklyn Bridegrooms. Why were they called the Bridegrooms? Because the majority of the team got married in the off season, so they changed the name to the Bridegrooms.
No
but
kidding.
That's why, yeah. Now, I'm not sure why and Doug Greenwald's listening. Cleveland Spiders, I'm not sure where the Spiders came from, but Doug will tell me. But that made me think of this for you guys. Well, number one, your philosophy of pinch hitting, which maybe you did, and, of course, you deal with pinch hitters. And, Bill, toughest pinch hitters you've ever faced and that kind of stuff. Let's talk a little pinch hitting, Will.
Okay, well, I would say this. You know, pinch hitting is one of the toughest things to do in the game. And I remember guys like Felipe Crespo had a great year for us with the Giants. And one guy that we got in the trade was John Vanderwall, was a great pinch hitter.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys, you know, they were always good fastball hitters. And I that's what your philosophy needs to be when you go up there in a pinch hit. Two things. You know, you got to be ready to swing the bat. You don't want to be taken and getting behind. You want to let the dog out on that first fastball you see near your zone because, you know, you're cold. You don't want to leave yourself one swing. And when you take a swing early in the bat, you know, you do time up the pitcher. You know, you get a better feeling. You get a little bit loose. You're timing up your swing to what he's doing. So, you know, the philosophy is you got to be ready to hit and don't be overly selective because you don't want to get behind in the count. Of course, everybody wants to hit a fastball, and that's why Bill's going to tell you when he got those pinch hitters off the bench, you never wanted to throw them a first pitch fastball because, you know, that's what they were hunting for unless you're going to sink it down away and get them to roll over. But you throw something off speed, but you got to be ready to swing the bat and you got to be ready to hit that fastball.
Well, you are 100% right, Professor Wotus, because you're not going to throw them a fastball because that's pretty much what every one of them is looking for is dead red fastball because they've been sitting on that bench 7-8 innings. And at Candlestick, I still don't know how Dwayne Kuiper and Harry Spillman did it because those guys were our best ones. But, you know, some of the guys that I remember, Manny Mota, of course, is probably the best pinch hitter ever in the game of baseball. He had a magic wand. Guys that faced me, I remember Reggie Smith from the Dodgers. He used to always one of those guys coming off the bench. Rusty Staub was another one that I was trying to remember, and I finally did. He was really good with the Mets because he didn't play much. He was that guy, you know, pants up to the knees, choke up, and then hit a bullet. But the left-hand hitters were tough. Jose Morales was another one that I was trying to think of as a big-time right-hand hitter, too. And, of course, in the Pirates day, I caught Stargell toward the end of his career. But Eastler, the hitman, would always be that tough guy, too, coming off the bench. So the left-handers were exactly right, Ron. I threw that sinker the first time, and if they were trying to crank it out of the yard, I was hoping they would top it over and hit a second baseman, but there's no way I'm going to challenge him with a cross-seam fastball, especially when you see the experience of these guys, their knowledge of coming off the bench. And as you said, Ron, they're guessing. They're looking for that cross-seam fastball to yank out of the yard.
Well, what about the 2010 to 14 team? You know, you guys did pinch hitting in there. Who'd you look to? Who'd you feel comfortable bringing off the bench?
Yeah, you know, nobody really stands out that, you know, he was, you know, a great pinch hitter. I think it was more about the matchup, you know, statistically, who was swinging the bat good. You know, of course, you know, my memory is failing me a little bit in 10 and 14, you know, who exactly were our bench players. But you always, you know, you always want to match up the guy and plan out the game. You know who the relievers are going to be and who your best guy is, who you want with men on base and who's going to be the first pinch hitter in the game. So, you know, it depends how the game goes. So nobody in particular comes to mind. I know we were struggling for a DH against the I think in all our World Series, actually. I mean, you go back to when in 2002, and I know it's not pinch hitting, but it's the same thing. What bat do you want in there as the DH? And, you know, we had several guys DH. I think Sinjo and Sean Dunstan, and then we had in Detroit, I remember Hector Sanchez was given a shot. He punched out three times. I didn't throw him a fastball, and then we went to Ryan Terrio. But you're right, Marty. It takes a special player that can deal with pinch hitter. And honestly, the best ones are guys that have had to do it. And I thought that Bill mentioned the great one that I remember, Harry Spillman with the Giants, had done it, you know, was a role player. And I think a lot of times your role players are much better at pinch hitting than the guys that are used to playing all the time.
Yeah, I was thinking.
Hey, Ron, let me ask you a question, Ron, when you're talking about pinch hitters and the mindset that they have to have. When they're sitting on the bench when the relief pitcher's coming in and the Giants get out of the inning and, you know, Boach goes to you, I want so-and-so going to pinch hit. Do you give him information on that pitcher right at that time? for the pinch hitter. How much information does he get on that opposing pitcher before he gets in the on-deck circle?
Well, Bill, the way it is today, it's not like the candlestick days where you're freezing, as you said, and you got to get off the bench and hit. I mean, these guys are down in the cages. They start hitting from the fifth inning on, and they have video of the guy on the mound, the hitting coaches, the assistant hitting coaches down there, giving him any stat that he wants, giving him the game plan, telling that individual what he's going to do to you. And but, you know, me as a bench coach, I never gave him any information on hitting. I might say something like, hey, when you get on, we can run on this guy, look to steal. But I always just tried to give him enough heads up to let them know where they might pinch it, at least two or three batters ahead, so they can start gearing mentally for who they're going to face, opposed to, you know, not knowing. You know, you get to the pinch hitter and there's three guys looking at you and then you pick them. I wanted to give them enough mental preparation to be at his best, go down in that cage, get his swings, and get his mind together.
Yeah.
Well, if you get the DH, you're not going to have any pinch hitters if the DH is the universal DH, so we're going to miss that. But when I grew up, Smokey Burgess, Jerry Lynch, Sam Spears, Dave Philly, Dale Long. There were guys. How about Lenny Harris? Remember Lenny Harris?
Yeah, from the Reds.
He holds a record, doesn't he, Marty?
Yeah, I think he does. He's from Miami Jackson High School, Lenny Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he grew up in Miami. So, yeah, it's a great part of the game. It's a great part of the game because when you're the pinch hitter and you get the pinch hit at the big moment, it's a tremendous lift for the team. So, guys, you're right. Veterans have to know. They know how to do it. I think you have to be a veteran. Yeah. All right, cool.
Yeah.
I like that. All right, we'll take a break. Always a great baseball discussion. A couple of things I want to talk about after the break. Taking pitchers out of the game. And, well, you've had to do it. And, Bill, you're a pitcher. You've been taken out of the game. And there's all sorts of stories. What do pitchers say? Do they acquiesce right away? Do you have to convince them? Do you make up your mind? Can they talk you out of it? And, you know, that kind of stuff. And there have been some famous incidents on pitchers being taken out of the game. And then pitchers, I was thinking about this because Trevor Hoffman, it's the anniversary of his 500th save, and he started off as an infielder. And I was thinking of pitchers who were former infielders. He's one. Kenley Jansen was a catcher. Joe Nathan was an infielder. So maybe changing positions, a serious change from, you know, being a fielder and a hitter to becoming a pitcher. So we'll chat about that. And I got a bunch more to talk about. So it's a beautiful Saturday night. And it's good to escape a little bit and talk a little baseball with Bill and Woe. So we'll do more when we come back right after this.